And just to follow up what Richard Wolf just said, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. And for those people who have yet to do so, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 516-620-3602. Now stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up.
And you're listening to WBAI New York. It's 7 o'clock, time for another remote edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only bomb for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood.
The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you tonight, joined by Kyle.
Yes.
You with us? Okay.
I am.
And by Alex, I believe. Alex, are you there in Skype land?
Good evening from Manhattan.
Okay, I don't know why your microphone sounds quite like that. You sound very echoey and tinny.
I don't know. That's probably
You sound like a memory in my head.
That's right. Yeah, distant and fading, I imagine.
Okay. Well, you know what? We'll adjust. This whole year has been about adjusting, and we'll adjust here as well. How have you guys been?
I'm all right.
Okay, Alex. Everything? Are you in Pennsylvania or New York right now?
No, I'm in Manhattan tonight. I'm in New York. I've been good, you know, but I'm feeling a little burnt out, to be honest with you. I'm getting tired. I mean, we're 9 months into this thing. I'm running back and forth between New York and Pennsylvania, dealing with the kids' schedules, the wife's work-from-home schedules, my work schedules, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff going on, work-related craziness, constant. You know, it's a lot. 9 months in, I'm starting to feel it. I'm getting tired.
Do you maybe want to push back a little bit and say, you know what, I'm not going to wear the mask anymore. I refuse to obey the rules. I'm going to eat in the restaurant, even if I'm the only one there. I'm going to gather at a church and a synagogue and just go to a baseball game. Any desire to do any of that?
I have not even a fraction of the energy that it would take to do even half of what you suggested.
Imagine. What kind of patriot are you?
I guess the liberal kind, you know, more, you know, more independent minded, that you know, that kind of patriot.
You hear that guy honking outside? That's a true patriot.
Yeah, that's
somebody
right.
Willing to cause a ruckus. No, but sure. Seriously, folks, stay inside. We're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. It's still a ways away, and there are still all kinds of complications that I'm sure are going to come up. But we have to do the smart thing. And so many people in New York have done the smart thing. And that's why we got through the spring. And yeah, it's getting bad again. We knew this was coming, and we need to get through this. There is a vaccine in the works. It's actually being applied to people in the United Kingdom, including William Shakespeare, I understand. And the day is coming for us soon, and things will get better.
Yeah, I think so. And one thing I would like to mention, I'm kind of proud of this. And speaking of, you know, doing the right thing, doing the intelligent thing. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, I'm excited to announce that at 4:30 p.m., the Financial Times is announcing the winners of the North American Innovation Awards for lawyers. And my law firm, Blackstone Law Group, we were actually shortlisted for an award about enabling business response to the coronavirus. And specifically the work that I did with respect to DNS monitoring, looking out for coronavirus-related threats, monitoring coronavirus-related domains, and detecting the attempted intrusion attempt on the World Health Organization back in March. So that's tomorrow. We find out whether or not we won the award. But given there is a lot of stiff competition, I think every other law firm that is shortlisted has over 1,000 lawyers. We're three, so wow. It's quite a bit different. It's a David and Goliath fight, but I think it's really, really cool and awesome to be recognized for that.
Is it too late for listeners to vote?
It's no voting. They're selected by research done by a specialized group known as RSG Consulting, and I think members of the Financial Times editorial staff as well. So
I see. So we just got to put some pressure on them. That's right. Get it. Okay. Message received.
So, message received.
Yeah, I do hope that you win tomorrow, and you certainly deserve it. It's been quite a year. The projects we've been involved in, the things that that we've seen, and of course all of our listeners as well, and so many courageous people that we have come in contact with and heard about in these very trying times. We're going to have a special guest coming up at the half mark of the hour. And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be doing something additional to the program. We're going to be doing something online. Stay tuned. We'll give you more details on that. And it's also a chance for those of you listening right now, whether you're local, whether you're listening in some other part of the world, as long as you're listening live, you'll be able to call us and talk to us on a regular telephone. So we have that coming up. We'll give you more details on that as it gets a little bit closer. But now I'd like to go into some listener mail. We got a lot of listener mail last week because you know why? We played those old recordings from the Voice BBS from the mid 1990s up until 2000. People loved to hear that, and everybody was able to point out something that I suspected, but it was pretty much confirmed. Here's one sample letter from someone known as Freakature. I'm listening to the podcast, which we are a podcast as well as a broadcast, of Off the Hook, where you're playing the audio files from your Voice BBS, and I think the sample rate is wrong. All of the voices seem pitched up like they've been huffing helium. I'm wondering if you've tried playing it back around 6,000 hertz rather than 8,000. Well, Freakature, in fact, it was wrong. We did it at 8,000, and that was too fast. It turned out the right setting was actually somewhere around 7,200, I believe. What I'm going to do is play you an old recording and then play you the fix after we applied the new settings. This is how the recording that you heard last week sounded.
Yes, this is the Jackal from the MPEA New York.
Okay, that's the Jackal. Now listen to him improved.
Yes, this is the Jackal from the MPEA New York.
This guy here, he sounds like he's about 15 years old.
Hey, it's out back in the Midwest checking in.
But now he sounds about 20 years older.
Morning.
Hey, it's out back in the Midwest checking in.
So it's amazing what you can do with pitch. So thank you, everybody, who pointed that out to us. In fact, we even heard from the guy responsible for helping us figure it all out and get these recordings rescued when we couldn't play them back for many, many years. Nobody knew how to get the format to play back. He wrote in, after listening to the show this week, I realized that we were a bit off on the audio ID. All the decoded recordings were a bit high-pitched, which indicates we were off on the sample rate. Instead of 8-bit unsigned linear PCM at 8 kilohertz, I think it is actually 7.2 kilohertz or so. So that is, in fact, what it is. I think it sounds great right now. In all my 30-plus years of doing this stuff, I've never seen anything with a 7,200 sample rate. Thank you, Andy, for all of your help, and glad to open up some new horizons for you. Yes, 7,200 hertz. Look to us to find something like that. We have a couple of other recordings. You want to hear a couple of the voicemail recordings from 20, 25 years ago?
Yeah.
Are these the pre-puberty sample rates or the post?
This is, well, it depends on who's calling. If it's an 8-year-old calling, it's still going to sound, well, yes, you're going to hear some kids who aren't kids anymore. And in fact, a couple of them are going to give out their email addresses, which I'm sure they're not using, but it would be fun if they were listening or if somebody knew them. Let's listen to one of them.
Hey, this is the Viking. Yeah, this goes out to mail 516. You were talking about the meetings. I really want to get these meetings going. I think 2600 Magazine said something about you have to have enough people. From what I believe, it may be wrong, but you may have to have enough people in order to get these meetings started. If you do want to go to a meeting, I want to make sure, you know, I see how many people I can get going, and then maybe I'll be able to contact 2600 and see what's going on. email me, if you get a chance, at vikingsecond.com. That is spelled V-I-I-K-I-N-G-2-N-D. It's actually vikingsecond@AOL.com, so... you could, you know, also, if you have any information about it, I'd really like to know about it, too, because I don't really know much about it either. So if you've had experience with these meetings in the past, whatever, you know, give me, you know, throw me a line. But, if not, I guess that's about it. So, I'll see you guys later. Hope to hear from you soon. Bye.
And yes, that was a 25-year-old message from someone named Viking 2, I believe. He was out on Eastern Long Island, and I remember he had left a couple of messages. We've heard a few of these where he was trying to get to a meeting, but it was too far away. So he may never have made it to a meeting, and this could be the first acknowledgement that he was trying. So I don't know if that's a friend of yours. Tell him the meetings will resume when the pandemic is over, and maybe we can all meet in New York City at some point.
Yeah, I think it's very cool. I also wanted to give you guys a preview of what it sounds like over here right now. I don't know if you hear the banging and the clanging.
We're picking that up, yes. What's going on?
As it would happen, the heat in my office building is just turning up.
That's the sound of heat?
Well, it's old radiators. This is a, you know, early 20th century building. And, welcome back to Manhattan.
Yeah, I don't care what century it is, but when you're designing a system and there's a lot of clanging and banging, how can you say with a straight face, yeah, this is a good idea? You know, this is what was sold to people back then.
Coincidentally, though, I did read an article yesterday about the radiators that you see in these old sort of pre-war apartments like my own over in the West Village, the gigantic steel radiators that, you know, are these coiled up extraordinarily heavy things. And apparently, these were designed, sorry about the background.
Oh, my God, it sounds like somebody's fixing a car or something.
You know, they might as well be. It would probably be less noisy. These radiators were designed during the Spanish flu pandemic, you know, just over 100 years ago, and were so incredibly powerful, and still are incredibly powerful, because they were designed to have the windows open while they were operating, so that you could have an apartment ventilating.
Oh my God.
While it was being heated. How extraordinary is that?
Not as extraordinary as trying to hear you over all that, but wow. You touched upon one of my sticking points here when you mentioned the Spanish flu. Alex, do you know where the Spanish flu came from?
Yes, it came from the United States.
Came from Kansas. Came from Kansas. Do you know why it's called the Spanish flu?
I don't exactly recall. I remember it was a bit of a misnomer.
Let me enlighten you. It was called the Spanish flu because World War I was very popular then, and everybody was engaged in that, and they weren't talking about anything bad. They weren't spreading bad news. So any reports of a pandemic were quelled, except in Spain. They were neutral. They weren't part of the war, so they reported, hey, guys, there's this pandemic going on, and it became known as the Spanish flu because they were the only ones talking about it. Yeah, didn't know that, did you? So
I didn't know that. I just forgot it.
No, I'm not addressing you. I'm saying in general, I don't think when we talk about the Spanish flu, somehow people blame Spain. Or, you know, you shouldn't blame anybody for something that you cannot control, like a horrible disease, like what we're going through right now. Anyway, we got kind of dark there. Let's go back to one of the messages. This is a very short message from the mid-90s. Let's hear it.
This is Sonic Hacker from 815. I was wondering why...
And that was the last we heard of him. Sonic Hacker from 815 was going to ask a question and never finished it. He just, I guess, got spooked or just didn't think that we'd have the answer. 815, was that what, Indiana? I'm not sure where 815 is. But yeah, if you're still out there, Sonic Hacker, you probably have had the question answered by now, but we might still know. Yes, Alex.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think that's Illinois.
Is it Illinois? Okay, I knew it was out there somewhere. And we have one more last message. Shall we listen to this one? All right, let's go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marilyn, 516. I just got a cell phone, and I'm looking for ways to clone it. So, does anyone have any information on the Motorola MicroTac Elite? You know, I never really heard of this kind, but I'm messing around with it. And I have some backdoor thing. And if you hit I'm not sure the buttons, but menu and another key, you get prompted for a PIN number. I'm not sure what this Motorola PIN number. If anyone has any programming for the Motorola name I just mentioned, because I'm not pulling it out again, please post it. I'd appreciate it. Dex, this is Middleman of 516. See you guys later.
Middleman from 516. I love how he forgot the name of his own phone and wasn't going to pull it out of his pocket again to look at it. There is some classic material here. I don't know if he was 6 or 12 or whatever, but he, you know, this is the fascination with technology and cloning phones that existed back then.
You know, and one point to make is that, you know, he's calling from the 516, but this was the mid-90s before 516 split into 631 and 516.
Yeah, don't remind me of that. It's another sore point for me when 516 was stolen from me and given to Nassau County. And, we were left with 631 out here in Suffolk County. So
he could have been calling from Suffolk, but I do remember that phone specifically. I think I actually had the Motorola TAC Ultralight that I had reprogrammed with an EEPROM reader writer that came into possession of in one way or another. But those were the days. I mean, that message really brings me back. I mean, that's a real blast from the past from the 90s to mention that particular phone, wants information about reprogramming it. It's incredibly cool stuff.
Yeah, and it's amazing. You would think an old voicemail or voice BBS recording from some kid in the mid-90s, why would that be of interest? And you just explained very accurately why that brings back memories, why that's something that's so important.
I just want to point out that's a not trivial thing to do at the time, and just to be interested in it, remarking that it's their device, like their phone. That's so familiar to a lot of people using handsets today, trying to get control over their own stuff, figure out how it works, make a copy of something. These are all really basic principles, and just that curiosity coupled with a desire to control your equipment is, I think, really timeless and cool to hear memories of the same attitude that we have.
Most definitely. There are a lot more coming. We have 4,000 messages. Of course, not all of them are voice recordings. Some of them are hang-ups. Many of them are hang-ups. And it's going to take a long time to go through them all and weed them out. But I'm sure there's all kinds of history there, and we don't know what to do with them. Some people have been asking, are you going to make them public? I guess, you know, messages like that that are meant to be public in the first place will put somewhere, and people will get to hear them in future weeks, months, years. Let's go back to listener mail, a couple other things. Let's see. A bunch of people wrote in trying to help us with satellite challenges. On iOS, Android, you can use an application called SatFinder Pro. It downloads a list of satellites for offline access. Also includes an AR feature that can use the phone's camera and overlay the satellite location so you can check for obstructions. And thanks, Richard, for writing with that. I don't know if that's the app that we use,
well,
Kyle.
There are a couple. I think one of our critiques of these apps, some of them you can't actually take a photo once you've lined it up. It doesn't overlay any of the targets or information about where exactly a satellite might be.
Yeah.
But what we're concerned about is also obstructions, like getting a clear shot. If it's something that's low in the horizon or something where you definitely have stuff that grows and you're trying to clear things, you need to have a idea of the spot in the horizon mm-hmm. you need clear, and no more, no less. That's, I think, the budgeting of that space.
See, the challenge is there's a satellite that we try to tune in on, and there are trees. What we need to know is what trees, what branches need to go for that satellite to be viewable. And there are lots of trees, so it's hard to tell which one specifically. And like you said, Kyle, the app that we used, it had an augmented reality feature, but it didn't allow you to take a picture, which I thought was the most asinine thing. Obviously, you're going to want to take a picture to show somebody this is what you need to cut right here. There was no way to do that. So ideally, what we need is somebody who is both adept at using the app, knowing something about satellites, and also not being afraid to climb up a tall branch and cut it off.
My crazy idea was to like put some sticks across the dish and try to point it in the general direction with like a laser pointer,
yeah,
and some tape, and it really turned into a mess.
It did. We used another app that pointed to the wrong part of the sky. We cut the wrong branch. When we had the chance, we cut the wrong branch.
Yeah, we kept coming back to thinking there's got to be a better way. This has to be like four geometry problems and like a whole bunch of calculus and done.
Lily writes, I am jamming to the song at the end of this week's episode. Would you please share what you know about that? So, well, that was Kraftwerk, I believe. Computer something?
Computer World.
Computer World. Yeah.
That's right.
So, look, sorry, our Alexa device there, its woke word is computer. So every time you say computer, it's going to answer. So let's not say that word anymore.
Stop saying that.
I didn't say it that
All
time.
Right, let's focus.
But yeah, that's the song. We're not going to say it again, but Kraftwerk, spelled with a K. And finally, you're off the hook from Colin. Someone mentioned on the December 2nd show that MCI doesn't exist anymore. You're half right. Verizon bought them in 2006, but they still operate as their own brand. Go to MCI.com to see that. However, if you call 1-800-444-4444, you're greeted by a recording that says, thank you for calling MCI, before it reads back your phone number. That still works. That's amazing. I tried it before. It does work. So people used to call that all the time when they wanted to find out what their phone number was, which, believe it or not, was something a lot of hackers knew how to do and most other people didn't. Now you just call someone else's cell phone, you see your phone number, it's easy. But you used to have to call 958 or 511 or various other three-digit codes to find out what your phone number was. And it was a big secret amongst the populace. Hackers had these little pearls of knowledge. And most of them have gone away. We used to have the callback exchanges, which out here was 230-250. In New York City, it was 660. You enter either 660 and the last four digits or the last seven digits of the phone number, hang up, pick up again, hang up, and it would ring. And that was really cool. We had an exchange out here called 480 where you would dial it and your phone would go out of service for about 5 minutes. 450 was even worse. It would go out for about a half hour. These were very handy to have. All these magical exchanges, they don't exist anymore. But I'm sure there are other things out there. A lot of people were feedbacking last week after the show saying, yeah, the magic has gone away. I got to tell you, when we were putting out 2600 in the mid-80s, 1985, our second year, people were saying then, it's the magic is gone. In our second year, people are always saying that, just like they're always saying today's music is nothing like, you know, the old days. There's always going to be something new, always something fun to explore.
When stuff's underrated like that, there's just more to explore and more that's abandoned and more nooks and crannies and unexplored territory because it's dismissed. Mm-hmm. It's thrown and tossed aside and it's for the bins, you know, the rubbish bins of history, as they say. All of that knowledge doesn't still apply, especially when they're really large, unwieldy systems that we rely on, and it's a process that people should explore and document, because the more it's forgotten, you tend to lose access, and applying the principles isn't as any less valuable, and so forth.
That is what the hacker community has always been about, is preserving that history of technology, learning from it, building something better, and just doing as many experiments as you possibly can. We had so much fun when we were putting together the Hacker Digest, which basically encompassed all of 2600 magazine from the beginning until now on a yearly basis. Reading articles from 20, 30 years ago is as fascinating as reading them when they first come out, because you're seeing how people were dealing with technology, what the challenges were then, how things have changed. And it's fascinating to hear, just like it's fascinating to hear an old radio program or TV program or newscast or something like that. There, you can always learn and always find that new bit to explore, to experiment with. So hacking is never going to die. It's always just going to morph into something else. But that spirit is going to last. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's correct.
Thank you for calling MCI. Our system indicates you are calling from.
Do you really want to give out your phone number over the air, Alex?
How did you guys do?
Yeah.
What's going on? You know, speaking of which, though, you know, some of this stuff is still relevant from 30 years ago. Some of the same tricks still work. I mean, think about calling, you know, your regular exchange plus, do you remember 9970, Emmanuel?
Yes. Test me on this. 9970 was the always busy suffix. So if you would call an exchange and end with 9970, it would be busy. 9971 would be a fast busy. Company test numbers, 99XX.
And what about 9901?
9901 would get you a verification recording saying something like, congratulations, you've reached the Williamsburg DMS. And it would list the exchanges that were in that particular central office of the phone company. Only in New York, I think, or the 9X region did that work. Maybe in other parts of the country, but I thought it was really cool how you could check out exchanges and learn. You keep charts, you make maps, and it was fascinating. A great way to learn.
Yeah, it really is. I'm impressed that you remember all of these. And what about 9945? You remember 9945?
9945. I know 9979 was a sweep tone, and 9950 would go to the central office before they changed those phone numbers. 9945, no, I don't think I know that one.
9945 was a weird test tone.
Okay.
It would be like sort of like an up and down tone. It was probably very similar to a sweep tone, too, but it was another one of these strange test lines from that was associated with whatever the switch was.
Interesting. There are all kinds of weird anomalies you'll still find. In fact, I demonstrated this the other day for some friends, because you have to do what you can to entertain people. I called a busy number and I got a recording saying the line is busy, but you can have Bell Atlantic keep trying for a charge of 75 cents. Bell Atlantic hasn't existed in how many years now? It's been over a decade, and that recording still exists. There are other recordings you can find. They're hidden away in various parts, and you can still go scanning and find all kinds of magical things out there. So the magic never goes away. It's always there in some form. Hey, let's talk about some of the news today. First, I also want to give out the phone number for the radio station to pledge to keep this place on the air. If you've enjoyed hearing some of our trips down memory lane or some of the technology we talk about, please give a call to 516-620-3602. Pledge whatever you can afford. Become a BAI buddy, where you pay a little bit every month. Keep WBAI on the air. Remember a year ago when we were taken over and we weren't on the air, and it was replaced by recordings, and the future was dire, and all the TV stations and all the newspapers came and wrote our epitaphs, and it was terrible. It was awful, but we fought back. We fought back in the courts, in the streets, in the cafes, various places. So we wouldn't be able to fight back now, I guess. It would have been much more difficult. But we got the station back. We're back on the air despite all the odds. Since 1960, WBAI has existed despite the odds. If that's not a story of hacker resilience, I don't know what is. You can be a part of that. You can vote and invest in WBAI by calling 516-620-3602 or going to give2wbai.org and pledging there. And it's a painless experience. It's it'll make you feel good, and you'll be keeping probably the most experimental and longest lived radio station in New York City on the air. And I don't think you can do anything better than that. Again, 516-620-3602 or give2wbai.org. And please mention Off the Hook is your favorite radio show, if it is, which I assume it could be if you're listening.
You can also SMS WBAI to 41444.
And you'll get a reply, and I guess it'll ask you some questions.
Yep, use that link and contribute what you can. Any contribution to this form of community radio is so welcome and appreciated for the operating costs, for the administration, and all of the programming and work that goes into airing our program behind the scenes. So thank you in advance for becoming a BAI buddy and sending us a little bit of your financial dollars.
Here's a rather disturbing story that we just got wind of. Do you remember about 8 months ago, there was this woman named Rebecca Jones who stood up against the Florida Department of Health by refusing to manipulate the data to justify reopening the state early. She basically was being asked by the state authorities or told by the state authorities to manipulate the data in such a way that the numbers would be lower than they actually were. She refused to do that. Well, Florida State Police have now raided her home and seized the equipment she was using to maintain a new independent COVID-19 tracker of her own. What in God's name is going on in Florida? Her tweet the other day simply said, "There will be no update today. At 8:30 a.m. this morning, state police came into my house and took all my hardware and tech. They were serving a warrant on my computer after DOH filed a complaint, Department of Health. They pointed a gun in my face. They pointed guns at my kids." And as hackers, we are well aware of that kind of behavior on the part of law enforcement. But this, for somebody who was a whistleblower, somebody who was trying to report the truth, what do you think they're after here? What are they trying to do?
It sounds a lot like intimidation to me. I'm sort of hesitant to pass judgment on this. It does seem rather heavy-handed the way in which they went about this, given that there doesn't appear to be any imminent threat that she was posing to anybody. To go in there with guns blazing is something that FDLE or the Florida Department of Law Enforcement should have really reconsidered before they did that. I'm not really clear as to what the exact charges are against this woman and the nature of the allegations that would support those charges. So it all seems to me at this point like it's a very heavy dose of intimidation, but I do want to reserve judgment on it because I guess it's possible that FDLE, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or the local district attorney's office there could have alleged that perhaps she stole certain trade secret information or walked away with certain types of proprietary technology or turning the tables on this, making the accusations for which one may oneself be guilty is not out of the realm of possibility here. It's quite possible and in all likelihood, I think probable that she will be charged with spreading some kind of false rumors about the virus or spreading false information about statistics and infection rates and things like that, simply because she refused to fall in line. I mean, we talked about this last week with Chris Krebs. People that refuse to fall in line and do the bidding of whatever the administration is are going to be on their target list. And so I think this is certainly a case that needs to be watched very closely.
It's staggering to me to see this kind of thing happening. Somebody who is reporting the truth, showing that the false numbers were being reported by the state authorities, and now she's the problem. Now she's the one that is having her home raided and is living in fear. We live in some kind of bizarre world. The other day I heard a meeting of the health department in Idaho. I might have some of the facts wrong here, but a meeting of the health department in Idaho had to be canceled because anti-mask people were trying to kick in the doors outside. This is some science fiction material that I would not believe because it just seems so far-fetched. But here it is happening right in front of us. Unbelievable. All right. Well, joining us right now is Dr. Welton Chang. Welton is the chief technology officer of an organization that you probably have heard of, known as Human Rights First. Before that, he was a researcher at Johns Hopkins, where he led efforts to develop technical solutions to fight disinformation and online propaganda. Sounds familiar. And before that, Welton was an intelligence officer with the Defense Intelligence Agency and received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, as well as an MA from Georgetown and a BA from Dartmouth. My God, you have so much in the way of credentials here. Welton, thank you, and welcome to Off the Hook.
Thanks for having me, Emmanuel, Kyle, and Alex. This is an absolute honor to be on the show, and I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time now.
Now, I understand you and Alex already know each other. It dates back, what, 17 years in Dartmouth, was it?
Yeah, it's hard to believe how long ago we've met. And in listening to the show and some of the voicemails that you were playing earlier, I want to say that 2600 and the hacker ethos and principles were something that inspired me growing up. And I'm a little bit younger than most of the folks here, but this is absolutely, I think the community that we want to try to engage and bring into the global struggle for human rights.
Yes, Alex.
Yeah, adding to that, Welton, is a little bit younger than me, thankfully. Also looks like he hasn't aged very much.
He has more credentials than all of us put together, yet he's younger than all of us. How is that possible?
That's true.
That is time travel.
Exactly. But Welton was an undergraduate at Dartmouth where we met, and we actually met first as colleagues and then became friends. I was in law school at Vermont Law, which is about 30 minutes away from Dartmouth or so, but being the asocial character that I am and sort of, very compulsive about studying, I actually hated studying in my law school's library because it was too much like a social hour. So I used to go over to Dartmouth, study over there, sneak into their library, and it became very easy to do because both Welton and I were research associates or, young intern-type research associates at a place called the Institute for Security Technology Studies at Dartmouth, which was I think it's called now the Institute for Security, Technology, and Society. Everything's for society these days. But it was a federally funded think tank that focused on cybersecurity and some counterterrorism research that we were doing. And that's where we originally worked together 17 years ago.
Amazing. Weldon, can you tell us something about what Human Rights First is and what your role is there?
Yeah. So Human Rights First, we're a 42-year-old human rights organization headquartered in New York City. We have offices in Washington, D.C. and L.A., as you would expect. We are known for our work in the asylum space. We provide direct services to asylum seekers, and we do a lot of work to hold the United States government up to the American ideals and the founding freedoms that we've all come to, well, many of us have come to believe in. We're an independent advocacy organization. We are developing capabilities to do more direct action. That's direct action in the courts and it's direct action through what I'm happy to, kind of announce here. We're going to be publicly rolling out an innovation lab at HRF. So that's what I've been working on at the organization for the last almost year and a half now. And one of the interesting things, I think, is last June when we first started to think about tech and human rights, and at that point I was still at Johns Hopkins, I think that there were a lot of things happening in the world that got people thinking about how important it is to better enable human rights organizations, human rights defenders with more capable technology. And I think one of the interesting things there was, I started hearing this. I gave a very, very kind of brief presentation about some of the issues that were, basically leading to tyrants and authoritarians around the world better able to consolidate their power as a result of the technologies they were able to harness to do that. And I think part of this was also the evolution of, my own thinking through the global war on terror, which, I was, a part of in some way. And then, through that time and seeing how, you know, the structures that I think maybe folks in your audience, maybe you yourselves kind of are decrying now in terms of the restrictions that we put around the internet. And the original founding ideals of the egalitarian ideals of the internet kind of disappearing to the point where we have a world where, you know, it's largely controlled by corporate interests. There are digital surveillance companies popping up left and right that are providing technologies to the governments of China and Russia and elsewhere. And we're seeing a world emerge before our very eyes that very much qualifies, you know, in the 1984 sense. And that's scary. And that's something that I think I looked at and I said to myself, I want to be a part of a group of folks who are going to fight back against that reality, that eventuality. And I want to take my skills to HRF to do that.
How much of a role do you see technology playing in the concept of human rights?
I think it's absolutely central. And it is, in some ways, I think the primary driver for a lot of the erosion of our innate rights as people. That's giving up our rights to privacy. It's giving up our rights to be free from, you know, hate speech and disinformation. And you know, Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights talks about being able to access information freely, but there's no clause in the UDHR that says like everyone has a right to have access to the internet, and not just access to the internet, but unfettered access, not mediated, moderated by corporate interests, whether that be ISPs or Facebook or some other organization. And, you know, I think that growing up in – so I'm going to give a little bit about myself away here. You know, I was born in the early 80s. So, you know, when you guys were doing your early work, I was non-existent. And in the 90s, what did I spend my time doing, right? Like trying to figure out ways to get free access to AOL, right? And
wow,
how do you stretch your minutes? How do you, you know, daisy chain those CDs that you got in the mail together that you could continue talking to your friends?
Were you on Our Voice PBS maybe in the 1990s? Do you remember calling in?
You know, I don't, but I will say that in 95, so I was almost a teenager at that point, and like a lot of other people, watched Hackers on Laserdisc.
Wow.
As absolutely, you know, Hack the Planet, all that stuff, I said to myself, this is, you know, kind of, this is exciting. And I remember my friends and I talking about, you know, I mean, we were making names up for ourselves and, you know, what would your hacker name be, right? And I'm sure you guys are laughing about this. and yeah, I mean, what were we doing? What were we spending our time doing at that point? We were trying to figure out how to share, you know, homework and, you know, answers to extra credit online in anonymous forums, right? Because we were, you know, in middle school and high school at that point, and trying to understand and live in a world that was becoming more and more connected. And, you know, when I graduated from college, that's when Facebook got its start. And, you know, we live in that world now. So
it's incredible. I think anyone listening in the past or currently who may have doubted what hackers can do, what people in the hacker community can do, just look at Dr. Welton Chang, the CTO of Human Rights First, after trying to figure out how to get AOL for free back in the day. There's all kinds of good that comes out of thinking freely and exploring and things like that and just questioning, and that's what it's all about. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, and I think you know, Welton's work is very, very far from done. I know a lot of our listeners had their interest incredibly piqued when you mentioned the Innovation Lab and some of the work that Human Rights First is going to be doing there. So you've got a background, Weldon, in combating disinformation and misinformation. This is obviously such a hot topic, becoming a compliance obligation of a lot of companies. And these platforms, obviously you mentioned Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Twitter, of course, rife with misinformation. Could you talk about some of the initiatives that the Innovation Lab is going to implement with respect to misinformation or disinformation, if there are any, and perhaps, combating extremism, things like that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We are watching this problem evolve before our eyes every day as we have to use these platforms to interact with one another, to get our word out. It's been accelerated as a result of the pandemic. We're in a world now where it's harder and harder to actually have face-to-face interactions. I mean, Alex, I think we've been talking about, trying to get together for an actual meeting, for some time and not being able to do that, right?
Yeah.
So we are so incredibly dependent on a mediated form of connection. And what does that mean? It means that we, unfortunately, are subject to, we're essentially bystanders in this information struggle between nation states, and even worse, I think, highly empowered non-state actors, the far right extremists who are using these platforms to mainstream ideas that in the past, were confined to garages and, midnight parking lot meetings where folks would break their hoods out and, get together and whisper to each other about, what their true feelings and beliefs were. And I think that human rights organizations, civil rights organizations, and, there are many great organizations doing work in this space and trying to hold the social media companies accountable. Where we see our direct input is leveraging data science skills. So it's not just me, it's members of my team, technology team, who have skills in understanding and building tools to better go through social media traffic to figure out, who's what, who's saying what, which narratives are catching fire, which areas are we should focus on. That's where we're going to bring our value add. And we're going to go beyond we will do advocacy as well, but I think direct action, doing the research, understanding the networks, and surfacing that information to people, that's where our bread and butter is going to be.
So is this going to help augment the core mission of HRF, or is it to sort of broaden the scope given the chaotic climate in media and news and social media? So is this broadening, I guess, the scope of the mission of HRF, or helping augment the current narrow focus or specific focus or underpinnings? Can you speak more to that?
Kyle, we're going to do both. I think the lab has significant internal functions that include building technology tools to, for example, help our efforts in figuring out whether or not global sanctions are working against human rights abusers. So that's a major program that Human Rights First is proud to have, under its belt. It's run by Rob Brzezinski, our senior vice president for foreign policy. Rob's team, it leads a coalition of 200-something NGOs that focus on the global Magnitsky sanctions. And so we're not just going to, say, interact with the human rights defense community and build tools to help them, but we're also going to look at what's going on internal to the organization and see if we can also bring to bear partnerships and tools to help everyone do their work better. And that also goes towards, counteracting some of the disinformation around the southern border, around refugees. And, like earlier this year, we saw a lot of information being spread about the folks coming across the border bringing COVID, which I'm sorry to say, but COVID's here. And now if you're crossing the border, I'm afraid you have a greater chance of getting COVID while you're in the United States than anywhere else, right? So
certainly true. We're speaking with Dr. Welton Chang, Chief Technology Officer of Human Rights First. I mentioned before we are going to be taking phone calls, and we will be doing that starting at 8 o'clock on our YouTube channel, Channel 2600. The phone number to call at 8 o'clock, not before then, is area code 802-321-4225. That's 802-321-HACK. Yes, we got that phone number, 802-321-4225. 8 o'clock, we will take phone calls. It will be streamed over Channel 2600 on YouTube and hopefully archived. We're going to try this so that we can actually take phone calls, which we haven't been able to do because we're not in the studio. And you can be part of this conversation for a few minutes anyway. Alex, yes, you had a question.
Yeah, building on what Welton was saying, I mean, I think that the initiatives that Human Rights First are taking at Welton's behest and that he's spearheading with Human Rights First are of course, you know, really near and dear to the hacker community's heart, too. If you think about going back to the original hope back in 1994, hackers have been trying to counteract the privacy invasive activities of repressive regimes, right? I mean, this goes back literally to 1994. Think about, you know, the last hope that we had where we were talking about, the last in-person hope, where there was a huge number of talks, I feel like at least five or six, that were all about extremism online, trying to identify extremism, trying to combat it, identify it, and put an end to it. And so, you know, I think, you know, we're getting sort of towards the end of the hour here, too. So Welton, I want to ask you, how can people stay in touch with Human Rights First and maintain this kind of enthusiasm? Because I know the hacker community is that all of these issues are near and dear to their heart.
Yeah. So next year, we're going to be publicly announcing rolling out the Innovation Lab formally. We will have more details about how the lab's going to function, but we definitely want to engage values-aligned technologists with our organization and link those people with skills and most of all with the wherewithal and the political will to assist with issues that we're hearing from people in, you know, folks in Hong Kong, folks in Belarus who we, you know, engage with, Egypt, and other places where, you know, I think oftentimes you interact with human rights defenders on the ground there, and their needs are very simple. And, you know, they may not seem simple for folks, you know, who are in the thick of things, but there are off-the-shelf solutions that they may not be aware of that we want to get out to them, and that it could also be open source technologies that we can repurpose for their use. So having that reach back capability, the kind of ability to directly assist people in need, that's one of the ways in which we see the Innovation Lab working as a hub and spoke.
Dr. Welton Chang, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Again, we're going to be continuing the conversation on our YouTube channel, Channel 2600. You can call us to become part of this conversation or to just check in and let us know how you're doing in the months we haven't talked to you. The phone number again is 802-321-4225. And you can, of course, write to us, oth@2600.com. We hope to see you on YouTube. Good night.
complicated times. Sometimes it seems like important voices get left out, and sometimes it's hard to know who to trust. But one thing's for sure. For more than 60 years, WBAI has been your go-to for independent, non-commercial, free speech programming. Join the WBAI family as a BAI buddy in the name of your favorite show today and support radio you can trust. It's easy. Just go to WBAI.org or call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602.